Welcome to Gay Mystery Podcast, featuring interviews with renowned LGBTQ authors and up-and-coming talent of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. I'm your host, Brad Shreve, and Justine Adamick is here with her weekly recommendation. Before we get to my interesting interview with Randy Boyd, I want to hear what you have to say, Justine.
Well, you know, Brad, before I give you yet another recommendation, I would like to know just what happened with that database of all our recommendations that have happened so far. Graham Cheater was very generous.
Yes, Graham Cheater was extremely generous to put together that database, and it was up on the old website, which I had up for about a week or two after he gave us the database.
Right.
So the website has been rebuilt. I don't have the database up on it yet. It's a little bit different than the old way. It's not going to be as easy for me to do it, but I will get it up there ASAP and we'll announce when it's up.
Wonderful.
I hope maybe next week, but I'm not going to guarantee.
Okay. Looking forward to that.
Yes.
All right. So what I have today is I noticed on Facebook this week that Marshall Thornton is putting out Pink's Video 5 called Cash Out in December. He's promising it in December. And the cover went up on his author page just in the last day or so. That's probably last week by the time this airs. And so I figured it was a good time to review the first book in the Pink's Video series.
Oh, that was a fun one.
That was a fun one. Okay, so the first book in the Pink's Video series was Night Drop, and it was the 2017 winner of the Lambda Award for Best Gay Mystery. Hidden Treasures is number 2. Late Fees is number 3, and that won the next year in 2018. And then finally, the fourth book is Rewind. It's called the Pink's P-I-N-X Video Mysteries. And it is a fine book. It's set back in 1992, and it begins right at the time of the Rodney King fires. It's just kind of dying down. And it's set in Silver Lake, where they have been, they've experienced the smoke and the ash falling down. I was living just north of Silver Lake, just up to the Glendale Freeway there. And I know we could see the fires from where we were. So Silver Lake, it was probably even more intense. So it's just settling down, and they discover that Noah Valentine owns the Pink's Video Store, which was, you know, how they were all over in 1992.
Yes, I do. And I've got to say one thing about the riots.
Yeah.
I didn't live in Los Angeles in 1992, but when I was reading what Marshall Thornton wrote about it, I felt like I was there. I felt like I was sitting in Silver Lake when all that was going on. But you go ahead.
Yeah, no, I got to tell you, it brought back, you know, all those days of the smoke and seeing and smelling it. You know, it was almost like I could go outside and still see it. It's very well written. So across the street, there's a store called Guy's Camera, and which were also ubiquitous in those days, the camera store, where you can develop film and the like. And that's burned to the ground. And the owner, Guy, also named Guy, who is a guy, he's dead in the store. They assume that it was part of the riots, but then it seemed too far away and too unconnected. You know, it's up there in Silver Lake where the fires haven't really hit and the riots hadn't really spread that far. He goes to Guy's apartment, and I can't remember how he actually gets there, and probably would have been a spoiler anyway. But as the guy's family is cleaning out the apartment, and he gets boxes of Guy's photos. They're just putting them into the dumpster, and he's taking it from the dumpster. And then, you know, of course, he gets involved in the investigation. And of course, there's a hunky detective. And of course, the hunky detective warns him off the investigation. And of course, Noah continues the investigation and ends up getting into dire straits. And as you're reading it, you're like, oh, wow, I never read this before, because he makes it all new again. He does it clever. It's written well. It's realistic. You realize that Noah Valentine is a character that you've never met before, and you just get absorbed into the book.
Yeah, and I shouldn't sing so much of the praise. That's your job here.
It's one of those rare books you've read, Brad. Go ahead.
Yes, it is. I felt like I knew Noah Valentine. I know this guy. So
yeah, I know this guy. I know this neighborhood. It's really wonderful. It's really a wonderful book. So I like slipped between, you know, glowing recommendation, a thrilling recommendation. It's just delightful. And I gave it a delightful recommendation.
Delightful recommendation.
Now, let me just say, it's a cozy mystery, which, you know, it's probably the first cozy mystery I've read that's set in Los Angeles. And as is traditional with cozy mysteries, he has a recipe at the end. Did you ever look at the recipe, Brad?
No, I don't cook.
Well, let me read you step one of this recipe for Louis' enchilada casserole. Find a really good mercado that makes his own tortillas. Go early in the morning and make sure to buy them from the grandma. She'll give you the fresh ones. If you buy them from the daughter, they'll be stale. You would have liked the recipe. You're going to have to go back and read it.
Yeah. I'm thinking of somebody in Montana trying to find a
mercado.
Mercado.
I think up there they have Mexicans who go up there and they have genuine Mexican food. Yeah.
I'm sure they do.
All right. So there we are. That's my review. And even though you read the book, now you have to go back and read the recipe.
Okay. Yes. I'll see if my husband Maurice will make it.
Just make sure he goes to the Mercado.
Yep, we got plenty of them.
That's right. Okay, so Recruit Tales today, we're coming out with The Always Anonymous Beast by Lauren Wright Douglas. It's a wonderful book. This is our second lesbian author that we're bringing back into print. The main character, Caitlin Reese, this is the first in the Caitlin Reese series. She has been a former Crown prosecutor in British Columbia, and she could not get all the justice she wanted there, so she left the practice of law, and now she's like not quite a private detective. She's got her own practice in which people come to her to right the wrongs, and so she's a bit of a mercenary, a bit of a social crusader, and all around a good person who restores justice through slightly unsavory means. And it's a great book. If Recruit Tales wasn't publishing it, I would be recommending it and saying it's a thrilling recommendation.
Okay. Good deal. Anything else you got for us today?
Nope, that's it. Okay. Looking forward to Randy Boyd.
Yep, it's coming up.
Sounds good.
We're sponsored by Recruit Tales, preserving our LGBTQ literary heritage one book at a time. Check them out at requeeredtales.com. Randy Boyd has been a professional writer his entire adult life. His four novels have been nominated for 5 Lambda Literary Awards, and all feature main characters who are Black, gay, and living with HIV or AIDS. 2 of them are mystery thrillers. In his first novel, Uprising, it was a 1999 Lambda Literary Award finalist in Best Men's Mystery and Best Small Press Title. Welcome to the show, Randy.
Thank you, Brad. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Well, I'm glad I asked you to be on. My first question, I'm going to have to look at my notes here because it's kind of long. You've had 4 novels that were Lambda Literary Award finalists. You've published romance novels, 2 short stories, a book that's a collection of short stories, blog posts, and essays. Plus, you've written 2 thrillers. I'm curious because Uprising was a 2015 Lammy finalist. yet you haven't published another thriller since then, and I actually haven't seen anything published since 2017. And I understand you're working on a sci-fi thriller now?
That's correct.
Why the wait?
Why the wait? Well, actually, Uprising was released in 1998, and it was a 1999 Lambda Literary finalist, Lambda Literary Award finalist. And my last published novel was released in 2005. So it's been a 15-year drought between novels. I've actually written a whole lot in the last 15 years, including on my blog and for other publications and some of the things you mentioned. But my last novel, my fourth novel, Walt Loves the Bearcat, is a 700-page book. It's kind of like the size of one of your Harry Potter books.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's a little fantastical like that. There's flying football stadiums. It's the story of a cheerleader and a quarterback, and they change the world by becoming the first openly out couple. It's a story that I've been dreaming of writing since I was in college. So we're talking 20 plus years of thinking about this story. It was a big story I had to get out of me, and it took a lot out of me in terms of being able to summon enough energy to do another novel. So that's part of the reason for the long drought between novels. Also, life gets in the way. But I think I needed that time to focus on writing things that were not big 700-page guerrilla-type novels.
Yeah, I can definitely understand that. The flying stadium intrigues me. And we are going to get to the cheerleading in a little bit later.
Okay.
Can you tell us about the story in Uprising?
Yes. Uprising is the story of a famous but closeted pop star in the early 90s, still during the AIDS panic, who tests positive for HIV. And his reaction is to join forces with two other famous but closeted celebrities. And the three of them become a force to be reckoned with. They plot the assassination of a homophobic U.S. senator, and an FBI agent gets wind of it and is sent in to go undercover to stop them. So when I was conceiving of a novel back in the late 80s, early 90s, I was thinking of three famous people, a combination of Michael Jackson and Prince for the pop star, Michael Jordan for the basketball star, and there was a media mogul who was a combination of Donald Trump and Ted Turner. Now, this is years before Donald Trump turned into the horrible president that he is. And so you've got these three closeted, famous, powerful figures, a singer, basketball star, and a media mogul. And they join forces, and they start supporting a group that is sort of like an ACT UP group. AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, I believe. So they join forces with this group, and they start first with some small disturbances, and then they eventually lead up to plotting the assassination of this homophobic U.S. senator, who's kind of like a Jesse Helms character, if you remember Jesse Helms, the senator.
I was in North Carolina, so.
So the senator in my book is from South Carolina. So, and his name is Jimmy Herman instead of Jesse Helms. So you can see there's a lot of familiar types in this book. And it's really, for me, I wanted it to be a page turner where you're looking at gay men, people with HIV, all different sorts of diverse LGBTQ people caught up in the things you'd be caught up in a thriller, chases, subterfuge, espionage, cat and mouse game. And so I wanted all these people to be caught up in this suspense and action and mystery. And it culminates at the end with an assassination attempt at the Jesse Herman Museum of American Decency opening.
Don't give too much away.
I won't. But yeah. That's Uprising, and that's my first novel.
Well, since you brought up Michael Jordan, I have a question. One time you were a contributor to Outsports.com.
That's right.
Do you see things getting better for queer athletes?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
In what way?
Well, when Outsports first came online, Outsports.com, it's still a very well-respected website, and you'll see oftentimes people from the website appearing on television as pundits when issues of gays and lesbians in sports comes up. When they first started in 2000, I'm not sure there were any major professional athletes who were out and open. And there still aren't in your major sports, your basketball, your football, and baseball. But there are so many out and openly proud athletes, Brad, in so many other sports, including women's sports, soccer, women's basketball, hockey. So the young person growing up today, thinking of being an athlete, but also being LGBTQ, has a lot, their outlook is a lot better. They can grow up, they can be who they are, they can play the sports they love, and they can get support around it, not only from their teammates, but from the gay community. Outsports is ripe with stories of people who've come out and been able to thrive in their sports. So things are a lot better than they were when Outsports started 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. We still don't have that major high-profile athlete in baseball, football, or basketball that simply says, I'm gay. Maybe they say, this is my partner. We're here. We're queer. We're going to play this sport. And like it or not, this is what it's going to be. We still don't have that in those three major sports. But we're much closer to getting there than we were before. So, yeah, I think things are a lot better than they used to be.
Yeah, I think it's coming soon. I don't know when, but I do think it's coming soon.
I agree. And one of the interesting things, Brad, was recently, you know, we just had our coming out day in October here. Well, I think it was last week. And the NFL did a public service announcement where essentially they were welcoming that person to come out. You know, there were some other heterosexual athletes in the spot, and they were all saying, it's okay, we'll be here, we'll support you when you're ready to come out. And so, I mean, that's a pretty big milestone, I think. You know, they're laying the groundwork. Yeah, and I think it's just a matter of time before a young superstar athlete says, this is who I am, and I'm going to play basketball, football, or baseball, maybe all three. And shock the world.
Yeah, let's hope it's soon.
I'd like to see it.
I am going to talk to you something I wouldn't bring up with another guest, and that's your HIV status. You and I met through Instagram, I believe, and on Instagram and on Facebook, you frequently share that you've been HIV positive since 1985, and you also blog about this. Why do you find it important to share, or I would say even celebrate your status?
Well, for so many years, I didn't celebrate it. I didn't share it publicly, at least. The first time I did share it was in 1991 when I wrote an article for Frontiers magazine about a week after Magic Johnson announced his HIV status. And if you remember that in 1991, it shocked the world and renewed the discussion about HIV. I wrote an article then in Frontiers. It was titled Just Like Magic. So it was acknowledging that I was HIV positive. That was 1991, of course, and there was no internet. And to find that, you had to pick up the magazine and read it. And if you didn't know who I was, you still didn't have access to me. You didn't know, see my picture. But that started the journey of me writing about and openly talking about my HIV status. And then it kind of grew from there. In the 90s, I started writing other pieces. And then my novels came out in 1998, and the first one. And there's HIV characters in those. And then the internet becomes a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm selling my books and making appearances and appearing in papers. And you're seeing my photo. I just sort of came out as a person with HIV naturally through my writing. And cut to this modern era where we have social media, and it gives you an opportunity to really be personal and to really let people see who you are. And I think it's important because HIV positive people need to be visible. We're here. We're not going away. We're part of the fabric of the world, of America. And after starting that coming out process with my writing in 1991, I wasn't going to back down in the 21st century, in the last decade where social media became popular. I wasn't going to back down. There's a lot of people on social media who are openly HIV positive, and that helps quite a bit. And then I also get DMs or emails or messages from people who are still struggling with learning that they're HIV positive and sharing it with their friends and family and coworkers and such. And that also inspires me to be honest and open and to show them, yes, I can be a comfortable person. You know, just like gays had to sort of go through, what was it, maybe 30 or 40 years of saying to the world, yes, I'm here, I'm queer, I'm okay, I'm normal, you respect me or leave me alone. People with HIV and AIDS have been doing that, you know, for the last several years. So I'm part of a group of people who are just being more open and honest about it. And I think we're helping pave the way for other people to live more comfortably and openly. And that makes all the difference in the world. That makes it worth it. That gives meaning to my life and my experience. And I don't think I could get that anywhere else.
Now, it sounds outstanding that you have given people someone to reach out to or even just read your work and say, there's somebody that understands. You actually remind me of the Billboard campaign a few years back where mostly they were around West Hollywood, but they are all over LA, where people that were positive were on the billboards and openly so, and trying to reduce that stigma.
Yeah, stigma is such a problem. And, you know, you reflect back to the mid-80s and even the 90s, where to tell someone you were HIV positive or you were living with AIDS was a very, very dangerous thing. You risked losing your job, maybe your apartment, your family and friends might abandon you. So we've had to come out as a way of survival, as a way of demanding a seat at the table and a voice, especially now that we're living longer and healthier and not so focused on, oh my God, I'm dying in the next 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
I think coming out for us, for people with HIV, is part of our survival strategy. You know, it's part of, you don't hide. You accept who you are and you keep living.
In your novels, you feature all your primary characters, at least, are Black, gay, and are HIV positive, which I feel kind of puts you in your own niche. How has that affected you?
Well, it's been good for my own self-esteem. I mean, part of the reason I write is I write so I can experience stories that I don't see other people telling. So I don't see other people telling a lot of stories about Black men, gay men, people with HIV. And so it helps me to see those, to create those stories and to see them. Does it put me in a niche? I suppose it could, but I like to use the argument that you don't have to be a soldier to enjoy a war movie. You don't have to be a mobster to enjoy The Sopranos. So you don't have to necessarily be HIV positive or Black or even gay to enjoy one of my stories.
Great analogies.
Thank you.
Have you ever been faced with the choice of writing what you want or writing what you think may be more marketable?
All the time. I remember a really good example of that was when I was first writing Uprising, and I was dealing with agents and some publishers, and there was one agency that was really excited about the book until they got a little hesitant, and they basically asked me, could you turn Uprising from a story about a Black gay man starting a revolution and assassinating a senator, could you focus more on the FBI agent who's going undercover to bust them, and, you know, make it that person's story? And that was a straight person's story. The FBI agent was straight. Mm-hmm. And so I had the choice then, you know, could I make Turn Uprising into a vehicle for a straight white man who goes undercover and figures all these things out about gay people? Or do I want to do a book about someone more like me, black, gay, and HIV positive? And the choices for me will always be a story that's closer to me than it is about someone else. I wouldn't be as passionate or interested if the person I was writing about wasn't black like me, wasn't gay like me, and wasn't HIV positive like me.
Well, I think it's great that you made that decision. I'm sure it was not an easy one.
No, it wasn't. But it's a matter of being true to my voice. Mm-hmm. One of the things I learned about writing, one of my writing mentors long ago, his name is Eric Wilson, and he's been a great mentor, talked about honesty of perception in your writing. And you can't have that honesty of perception unless you're really coming from a place deep inside you. And for me, again, it's going to be about those things. It's going to be about being gay, being black, being HIV positive, at least until I run out of things to say about those aspects of me. And I'm not even close yet.
Still plenty of places to go with that.
Absolutely.
We talked about Uprising. And your other thriller is The Devil Inside. Mm-hmm. Briefly, what are the differences between the two, Uprising and The Devil Inside?
Well, let's see. Uprising is that assassination thriller. The plot completely revolves around this assassination, whether it's going to happen or not, whether or not the characters think it's a good idea, whether violence is the answer. And The Devil Inside is more, it looks more inward. That's about a black, gay, HIV positive businessman who gets caught up in a thriller and a plot that goes beyond him. And basically, without giving away too much, he discovers a conversion therapy outfit that has a lot of very crazy, sick, wacky things going on. I mean, what gay conversion therapy group doesn't, right? But he discovers these people, and, you know, a lot of them are ex-gays, as a lot of the conversion therapy people would be, you imagine. And so they have some very twisted ideas, but the main character is forced to examine those ideas and see, are they really true about the gay community? So whereas I think Uprising is more about what could we do about the struggle for gay rights and recognition? Should we be violent and should we assassinate people? The Devil Inside is more like, how far have we come? And do these conversion therapy folks have a point about our society, about the gay community being degenerate and in need of some sort of conversion?
And I believe you have The Devil Inside, if I'm correct, classified as a science fiction thriller. Is that correct?
I don't think it's marketed that way, but there are definitely some science fiction elements to it. It's said to take place in the very near future. So the novel came out, I believe it was in 2002. And so it takes place maybe a decade or more, probably about right now, where technology is a little more advanced and there's a lot of virtual reality techniques and gizmos that they use to try to convert people from being gay to straight. But it's simply called a suspense thriller, just like Uprising.
And your current work in progress, do you anticipate that being the same?
That is definitely going to be a full-blown science fiction mystery thriller from the top.
Any idea when you may be getting that out?
I'd love to see it come out by next year. I'm imagining it's probably going to be a book series, so maybe anywhere from 4 to 6 books. Mm-hmm. I'd like the first one to come out next year, hopefully, maybe around this time, but I've still got a long way to go.
I feel that. I have one that I'm working on now that it feels like it's going to take forever, and I'm really working hard so it doesn't take forever.
Right.
Now, on social media, in addition to talking a lot about your HIV status, you frequently delve into having been a cheerleader for both the University of Southern California and UCLA. Tell us about that time in your life.
Well, first and foremost, I've been a cheerleader my entire life. even to this day, and I'm 58 years old now. And I first fell in love with cheerleading when I was 7 years old, and my sister was 12, and she was trying out for her junior high team. And our family was moving to a new school district, and on moving day, the family had my sister and me wait in our new empty house all alone, all day, waiting for deliveries and furniture and things like that. So it was just my sister and me, and she was trying out for cheerleading, and she was going through all her cheers and using me, her little brother, as her co-cheerleader partner. And from that day on, Brad, I fell in love with cheerleading. And I grew up in a sports family, played a lot of basketball, football, and baseball, went to a lot of basketball games with myself and my brothers. And I always paid attention to cheerleading. From that moment on, it's from 7 years old, I became a student of cheerleading. So by the time I got to college and was able to actually try out for cheerleading, I was kind of an amateur expert at it. And I knew I wanted to be a cheerleader in college. That was my first opportunity to actually be a cheerleader, to try out where they had male cheerleaders. And I really wanted it. And I did. I tried out a month after I started school. They had tryouts at USC, and I made it. And I was essentially a cheerleader for four of the next 5 years in college, two at USC, two at UCLA. I had a blast. I lived a lot of my dreams, being down there on the sidelines, right in the middle of the action, being in the center court or in the middle of the field, all the attention focused on me and the other cheerleaders. It was a blast, although it was kind of a mixed blessing, because this was in the early 80s. And although I was a cheerleader, I was completely in the closet in college, and that made it a little difficult, needless to say.
I think that we're seeing that change. I think we've seen that change quite a bit.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's amazing now. There's, if you're a young boy at 7 years old now, you can become a cheerleader today. You can go to a cheerleader gym and learn cheerleading and learn stunts, and you can start cheering right away. You don't have to wait till you get to college. And this, I think, is the golden era for males in cheerleading now. There's even male cheerleaders now in pro football and basketball. And I'm not even talking about the male cheerleaders who do stunts where you lift up the girl and so forth. I'm talking about male cheerleaders who are dancers, who are actually dancing right alongside the girl, female dancer cheerleaders. And many times they're carrying pom-poms as well. You've got cheerleaders, male cheerleader dancers for the Los Angeles Rams, for the likes of teams like the Atlanta Falcons, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, New England Patriots, just to name a few. And it's a great time. There's on social media, there's a hashtag Black Boys Cheer, and it's full of all these young men of color and cheerleading at all different levels. And many of them are out and openly gay, and it's just a wonderful thing. They're getting support. They're allowed to be who they are. Cheerleading has become a sport now. They're more recognized as athletes. It's really a great time to be a male cheerleader now.
Well, I don't follow sports much. When I do, it's baseball. I love baseball. But I think I need to expand my horizons, because that sounds fantastic to watch.
It really is. It's exciting to see. I don't know if you're familiar with the show they had recently on Netflix called Cheer.
I've heard of it, but I've never seen it.
Right. It's on Netflix, and it's a reality show. It follows a group of cheerleaders at one of the best cheerleading schools in the country. It's in Texas. It's a smaller school, but they have an excellent cheerleading program, and it follows the cheerleaders. And many of the stars of the show are the young Black gay men on the squad. They've gotten a lot of attention. They've become sort of celebrities in the cheer world. They have thousands of followers. So, you know, we've come a long way since I was a Black cheer boy 40 years ago. And it is something, it's something amazing to see. I guess it's similar to how gays in so many areas have grown up to thrive and be open and who they are, you know, the great miracle, I think, that of our lifetime.
Yeah, I think it's always been an unspoken, but okay if your interior decorator or your hairdresser was gay. But
right.
Now we've expanded way beyond that. That's great.
Well, it is. And that's the beautiful thing, I really think. You know, when I was growing up, like I said, I'm 58, so I grew up in the 70s mostly and somewhat in the 80s. And people were just learning that there were gay people out there. In fact, people weren't even using the word gay when I was growing up. You were a fag. Mm-hmm. That's what you were. And it didn't even necessarily mean you were a homosexual. It's just that you were different than other people. And they labeled you a fag. And now we have people who are not fags. They're gay. And they're all kinds of people, you know, not just stereotypical things like hairdressers and other things that people thought, oh, all gays are this way and one way and they do this one thing. We've totally blown the lid off of all those stereotypes. And that's just been an amazing gift to experience in this world.
Like, hey, folks, we are actually everywhere.
Yeah. We're fathers, we're brothers, we're sisters, we're politicians, we're athletes, we're everything.
Yeah, I was married to a woman when I came out, and her family, they thought it was just my way of getting a divorce because they refused to accept that I was a gay man because I felt I acted like none of the stereotypes that they assumed. And we were like, well, getting a divorce is easy. You know, she's like, why would he go through all that trouble? But it took a while to convince them. It's really funny. Yeah,
that's amazing.
Your book, The Essential Randy Boyd, it's a collection of essays, blog posts, and excerpts from your novels?
Yes, a couple of excerpts, a couple of blog posts, some original writing, and also some writings that appeared in other publications.
Okay, it appears to delve into your personal life, like who you are. Did you find that difficult to write?
I found it difficult to put together as a representation of who I am. Because a lot of the stories in The Essential Randy Boyd are kind of raw. There's one titled Sometimes I Forget I'm a Nigger. And that was my reaction to the Rodney King riots of 1992. Again, it was written for a magazine, Frontiers Magazine, that lays raw some of my feelings about race. There's another story in there about something that happened to me when I was a freshman at USC. I was called nigger the week before school started, and it was a devastating experience for the 18-year-old freshman. That was actually 40 years ago, this past September. So that's pretty raw. There's another story in there about an abusive experience that I had when I was a child, and it kind of I turned to the family dog for comfort at that point. There's another story about feeling like the most unlovable nigger faggot in the world. That's a quote from there. So there's a lot of raw things there. There's also another story about called Left for Dead, which was a story that originally appeared in ANU magazine. That was in 2017. And that talks about feeling like a lot of my friends and coworkers left me for dead when I announced I had AIDS back in the 90s. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of raw emotion in there. It was a little challenging to put it together, knowing that I was going to, you know, put this all out to the world. But I knew I had to do it because I wanted there to be a collection that if someone was only going to read one thing by me, I wanted them to be able to know me, who I am, what I've been through, and that's The Essential Randy Boyd. So it was difficult, but I knew it had to be done.
For information on your two thrillers, Uprising and The Devil Aside, as well as your other books, is the best way to find that is through your website?
Sure. They can go to my blog at randyboydsblocks.com. Blocks, like a child plays with blocks that have letters, and he puts them together to make words. That's what Randy Boyd's Blocks comes from.
Okay.
Or you can also just type in Randy Boyd if you're on a bookstore site or Amazon, or at an actual bookstore, you can just look up my name, Randy Boyd, and usually the books will come up. Now, there may be some other books by some other Boyds or other Randy Boyds, but I think if you're looking, you'll see, you'll get the gist when you start seeing books with black gay men with HIV coming up. you're kind of, oh, that Randy Boyd. Yeah, yeah, there's that one and that one and that one.
Yeah, I found the right guy.
Yeah. So they can either go to my blog, randyboydsblocks.com, or just put my name in any bookstore search engine and they'll come up.
Okay. And I'll be sure to put those links in the show notes as well. So make it easy for people to just hit the button and get there.
Thank you.
Well, Randy, it has been a pleasure to have you on the show. I appreciate you coming on.
Well, thank you very much, Brad. It's been a pleasure.
Hit the subscribe button wherever you hear our show so you don't miss a single episode. Tell a friend too. Thank you for listening.